Our revolution, their revolution. Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Human rights monitors reach the most bombed-out city in Yemen, where Saudi forces have targeted every market.
Maybe they would argue, well, if we get rid of the marketplace, it means the fighters in town have a harder time buying food. But any civilian who's living in that town now can't buy food either.
And in Colombia, bomb blasts rock the capital, Bogota, and residents are on edge. Plus, we visit the little English village that usually celebrates the 4th of July in a big way.
Thousands of people come, and they have what you call a fun fair or carousel or whatever you like to call it. And they have fireworks, and it's a jolly good day, and it's looked forward to ever so much by the locals.
But not this year. Those stories are coming up today on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're going to help you prep for the July 4th holiday weekend on the show today. Fireworks and grilling, how we do it, how others do it. But first, let's focus on a nation still in the throes of its own revolution, Yemen. Today marks the 100th day of Saudi coalition airstrikes on Yemen, and the NGO Human Rights Watch got access to what may be the most bombed-out city in the country. It's called Sada, not to be confused with the capital, Sana'a. Sada is near the border with Saudi Arabia, and it's a home base for Yemen's Houthi rebels, the ones the Saudi-led coalition has been trying to defeat. As I mentioned, Human Rights Watch investigators were just in Sada, and they were looking into the deaths of nearly 60 people, including women and children. And the investigators say those deaths violate the laws of war. Belkis Villa is one of the authors of that report. She says her team went to Sada specifically because it's been totally cut off from Western media.
The first night of the war, the coalition bombed the telecommunications centers. So there's no phone network, absolutely no internet up there. So it's been sort of a free-for-all. The coalition can bomb whatever they want. And we really wanted to focus our research there because it's one of the areas where the least amount of information has gotten out.
How big a city is Sada?
Sada is usually home to about 50,000 people. And on May 8th, Saudi Arabia actually issued a statement around 11 o'clock in the morning saying, by 7 p.m. tonight, we view the entire city as a military target. Now, that's a very, very blatant violation of the laws of war. Now, in this war, Saudi Arabia levied a naval blockade on the country. The result of that has been very little fuel coming in. So that means people don't really have enough fuel to run cars. So you saw people trying to flee actually on foot. Very few families, therefore, could get out by this 7 p.m. deadline. So a lot of families were stuck and couldn't abide by that deadline. When I got into Sada, which was about 4 weeks ago, I'd say by now it's pretty much a ghost city.
Now, when you say Sada is one of the hardest hit places, I mean, we're talking about a city that's got some 200 bomb craters, from what I've heard. What makes an airstrike unlawful during a war?
So one of the key principles of the laws of war is that the side of the war that's carrying out the strikes has to constantly discriminate between military and civilian objects, and it cannot carry out strikes on civilian objects unless they're being used for a military purpose. They also have to make all efforts possible to avoid civilian casualties. While we did not see Saudi Arabia and the other members of the coalition directly targeting groups of civilians, we did not see them taking care to avoid damaging civilian objects. In fact, we saw the opposite. We saw a pattern of attacks on, for example, every single key marketplace in the city. Those targets happened most of the time in the middle of the night. So it doesn't look like they were trying to hit, let's say, a Houthi commander that was standing in the middle of the marketplace. Instead, they were actually trying to remove the marketplace itself. Maybe they would argue, well, if we get rid of the marketplace, it means that the fighters in town have a harder time buying food. But any civilian who's living in that town now can't buy food either. So that's why these strikes are so problematic under the laws of war. It means that they have a disproportionate effect on the civilians that are still living there.
Now, you mentioned the lack of communications coming out of SADA. Is there anything to suggest that Saudis are targeting SADA specifically because they know they can do it with relative impunity?
Well, I think Saudi Arabia and other members of the coalition carrying out airstrikes are targeting SADA particularly because it is the stronghold of the Houthis, their target in this war. I also think that they do know that because so little information is coming out of there, they can be less careful. The other thing that we at Human Rights Watch have documented is the use of cluster munitions that are inherently indiscriminate in that they cannot differentiate between military and civilian targets. Very problematic. 116 countries around the world have said these should never be used. Unfortunately, the United States, Saudi Arabia, and Yemen are not countries that feel that that's the case.
Well, you mentioned the U.S. support for the Saudi airstrikes. The Saudi-led coalition has also been accused of using U.S.-supplied cluster munitions in Yemen. Do you see any evidence of that?
Absolutely. So we've documented the use in 5 incidents of cluster munitions, 3 different types of cluster munitions, 2 of which are U.S.-made, U.S.-sold to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. And interestingly, all 5 incidents have been in SADA. So again, I think we see that the coalition is willing to do things in SADA that they're not doing elsewhere in Yemen because of the lack of information getting out. And therefore, they see it as an area where there's less scrutiny and the bar is lower. And therefore, there's more they can get away with.
Ms. Villa, your organization, Human Rights Watch, is calling on the Saudis and the Houthis to abide by the laws of war. What would you like the United States to do?
Well, we would like to see the United States as a friend to Saudi Arabia, to put a lot more pressure on Saudi Arabia, first and foremost, to be much more careful in the way that they're conducting this war. That means abiding by the laws of war that require you, when you carry out a strike, to do all of the things we've mentioned, to carry out strikes only on military objects, legitimate military objects, not civilian objects, to take all possible measures to minimize civilian casualties. That includes, where possible, giving warnings to civilians, giving them enough time to leave the areas. But then the second part of it, which is where you carry out a strike that goes wrong, so we see a large number of civilian casualties, that you carry out transparent investigations and you hold accountable those that were in command control of that strike so that there is a remedy, so that the family that lost members of their family get compensated and that there's a fix in the process, so that going forward, we don't keep seeing strikes with such a high civilian death toll.
Belkis Villa with Human Rights Watch speaking with us from New York. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Okay, let's talk about this weekend's 4th of July celebrations. Here in the U.S., cities are being told to be extra vigilant and to put extra uniforms on the streets this weekend. That's because the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI have issued an alert about possible terrorist attacks. Officials say the alert is not due to any specific threat, but even so, the concern has spread overseas. Take the village of Feltwell in England. There's a U.S. airbase there, and each year the village puts on a serious July 4th party. Not this year, though. The good folk of Feltwell were told there won't be any celebration this year, and they're upset. The reason for the cancellation was due to local threat assessments. So to find out more, we reached Peter Cooper. He's a counselor in Feltwell.
It was a surprise to everybody, I think, because it was only a week ago that the officer in charge of Feltwell came along and told us what preparations were going ahead, and everything was all right.
And was an explanation given?
No. Well, no, apart from trouble in Tunisia and places like that.
So related to some of the extremist activity around the globe.
That's right, yes. I don't think your folk want any extreme organizations coming onto the camp.
Yeah. Who does?
Yes, exactly.
What normally would happen at the celebrations in Feltwell, the 4th of July celebrations?
Well, they open the gates and thousands of people come and they have what you call a fun fair or carousel or whatever you like to call it. And they have bars and things and fireworks and a display of aircraft by Red Arrows and other little planes. And It's a jolly good day, and it's looked forward to ever so much by the locals.
What kind of things are there to eat? Typical American fare?
It's American fare, yes. Hamburgers and donuts and beer in cans and things like that.
So why do the people of Feltwell enjoy these celebrations?
I don't know. I just don't know, because it's, we lost the Americas on that day, didn't we?
Exactly.
But they do. It's very popular. Everybody looks forward to it.
So do you think the Brits have forgiven us for that whole revolution thing?
Oh, I think that's all gone and forgotten. I shouldn't think half of them remember it now anyway.
So tell me what you will be doing to celebrate the 4th of July. Or are you just going to put it on pause this year?
Oh, well, I shan't go up there tomorrow, and that's it. You know, that'll be one place I can't go to tomorrow.
Well, sorry to hear that, Mr. Cooper. I hope next year things will be back to normal.
I certainly hope so. For all the people in the village and the surrounding area, you know, we look forward to it, and we're sorry it's been cancelled.
Peter Cooper is a councillor in the village of Feltwell in East Anglia. Happy 4th of July to you, a day early.
Thank you.
Okay, so the 4th of July isn't just an American celebration, but the 5th of July might be this year if the U.S. women's soccer team can beat Japan in the finals of the Women's World Cup on Sunday. Victory for the American women is not a given. Japan beat the U.S. in the 2011 tournament final. To get the Japanese perspective on Sunday's game, we got reporter Naomi Gingold on the line in Tokyo. She says the Japanese victory 4 years ago changed a lot of attitudes.
Soccer is a really big sport here, but up until that time, you really didn't see much attention being paid to women's soccer. You know, even in schools, you know, you see women's volleyball, you saw women's swimming. Women aren't even really encouraged to play soccer that much growing up here. But after that 2011 World Cup win, people started paying attention. People know the names of the big players. So,
take us back to that moment in 2011. It was a historic game for Japan, as you just explained, but just, you know, how Japan saw it.
It was after the triple disaster, the earthquake, tsunami, the nuclear meltdown. Japan was trying to get back on its feet, and people weren't really paying attention to the women's team. And I think it was kind of a stunning victory for everyone who saw it, and everyone was kind of on the edge of their seat, especially at the end. You know, up until, I guess, like the last 10 minutes or so, the U.S. was actually in the lead, and they went into overtime, and then they went into penalty shootout, and that's where Japan finally beat the U.S. 3-1.
Right. I mean, I've been reading the sports pages today. All the women on the U.S. squad are trying not to think about that and just move forward. It's safe to say, though, that 2011 kind of flipped things in Japan and that people there, Japanese, have been following this World Cup from beginning to end, yeah?
I think people are generally were pretty excited. I think the semifinals, again, were kind of like, oh, hey, this is our awesome team. We need to all start paying attention. You know, it's a bit of a rematch in a sense for both teams here, because after the World Cup in 2011, you know, the U.S. beat Japan in the Olympics in 2012.
Oh, right. So it's kind of the rubber match in a way.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I think both have a lot on their minds going into this.
This Japanese squad, they're called Nadesco. What does that mean?
Yamato Nadesco is a term in Japan that's used to refer to Japanese women, and I guess it comes from a flower. There's also a very famous anime that I'm sure some certain like Japan fans will be into hearing about. Nadesco was a character, and I think she was a pretty strong character. So, you know, I think it says a lot about these really strong women on the Japanese team here. The really big star player that everyone knows, she was the captain in 2011 and was FIFA's Women Player of the Year the next year, Homare Sawa. She's going to actually be the only player ever in World Cup history to play in 6 World Cups.
You know, it just suddenly struck me as we were dialing you up, Naomi, that you're way ahead of us time-wise and that this World Cup match will be happening Sunday evening local time, but Monday morning in Japan. So where are you going to be watching it, and how many Japanese are going to be calling in sick or tired or sick and tired on Monday?
I might be at home with NHK. They're going to be broadcasting the game. I think that's been a big issue for this whole World Cup. You know, I think people have been pretty excited about the games, especially since the semifinals. But the time zone has made it really hard. You know, even people I spoke to who were pretty excited about the game were kind of like, well, we're going to be on our way to work. We can't really, you know, get out of that.
Well, good luck and try and stay awake. Reporter Naomi Gingold in Tokyo. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Marco.
Stick around. We're going to throw some tasty stuff on the grill in just a minute, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Whether it's charcoal or gas or an open wood fire, tomorrow a lot of you are going to load up on fuel to start your 4th of July grilling, because nothing says successful revolution better than a piece of meat exposed to an open flame. We're talking grilling traditions and grilled food around the globe with our old friend Steve Dolinsky. He's in Los Angeles, and Steve, I know where you're going to start things off. Right there in the City of Angels in Little Tokyo, yakitori.
Yep, just outside of there, I was noshing on a little bit of yakitori at a place called Robata Jinya. And Robata refers to that wonderful source of grilling in Japan where they grill all kinds of things over these binchotan charcoals, which get blazing hot and keep their heat for many, many hours. And I just love chicken thighs. They're just so juicy and moist, and yet there are so many other parts of the animal that they grill in Japan. I mean, they grill the tail and the beak and the skin and the intestines. I mean, you can get really crazy funky on the offal, but I love the chicken thighs, and so that's kind of what I gravitate to when I go to yakitori.
And I know yakitori, they grill pretty much anything, but mostly is chicken, right?
It's mostly chicken, yeah. Yakitori does refer to grilled chicken, but I guess the term can refer to anything that's been skewered. And typically, very simple seasoning. They do not marinate it at all. I mean, you'd see, like the Thai version would be, say, tei skewers, which they marinate in coconut milk. Mm. But these are just either with salt or with tare, which is a combination of mirin, sake, soy sauce, and some sugar. And you'd brush it with that tare during the grilling process. But very simple, not very much seasoning at all. Also with a very tall, cold Sapporo.
So the Japanese often do yakitori on skewers, and the skewer is also the spine, if you will, of so much grilled stuff in the Mideast. Kebab, souvlaki, doner kebab, gyro. Is it all like baklava? Pretty much everyone in the Mediterranean claims they invented it.
I think it is. You know, when you mentioned doner kebab, though, you've got to be careful with that term because that could refer to like a gyro, or like in Mexico, they call it al pastor. That's where they've got the ground beef and lamb up on a vertical spit, and they're slicing it off into little sheets, as opposed to shish kebab or kebab in Iran, shish kebab in Turkey. That's where we're talking about those hunks of meat or chicken or goat even on a skewer. And this, of course, comes from, you know, ancient medieval soldiers using their swords to grill food over open flames out in the countryside.
So a lot of Americans tomorrow will colloquially say, come on over for a barbecue. So just to get the lingo right, you and I are talking not barbecue, we're talking the grill, and that's very different, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because everybody does in America say barbecue. And the purists would say, well, hang on a second, barbecue refers to low and slow. And when you say barbecue in the Carolinas or in Memphis or in Texas or in Kansas City, you're talking about very slowly cooked ribs, shoulder, brisket if you're in Texas. And so this is not what we do in America. We grill. And I think that's it's an important point of distinction. You know, we like it quick in America. We're very, we're a little ADD. We are impatient. We want our food relatively quickly. Unless you've got a backyard, you know, oven in the ground, typically I want it within the next 15, 20 minutes. So yes, we are grilling. We're grilling over live fire. We're grilling over charcoal or in some cases gas. And there's no shame in gas, by the way.
Yeah, and anybody coming to my house tomorrow, feel free to do some barbecue low and slow, and then I'll put it on my grill to get a nice crisp on it. Take us way south to Argentina now, Steve. They love their beef. It's what's for dinner and lunch and maybe even for breakfast. How do the Argentines grill?
Yeah, this is the sort of the gaucho tradition, the cowboys way out on the plains. And the big chef down there, the celebrity chef, is Francis Mallmann, who's sort of popularized this. He's got a great book called Seven Fires. It's basically two ways. One would be on a chapa, or what they call a plancha, kind of a cast iron griddle. But the more common version, we would see the parrilla, I think that's pronounced right, the parrilla, the barbecue grate, always over live coals, and we're always talking meat here. And so if you go to an Argentinian restaurant, you'd ask for things like lomo, which is the tenderloin, or my favorite, which is entraña, which is the skirt. I love skirt steak because it marinates so well and cooks really quickly. Vacío, which is the flank, and then the really popular one, the bife de chorizo, a sirloin or New York strip equivalent. Always grilled very simply. We're talking salt and pepper, not a lot of marination. And then, of course, the ubiquitous sauce is chimichurri. Parsley, garlic, olive oil, oregano, vinegar, all kind of blended together into kind of a chunky sauce paste that just comes alongside that beautifully cooked beef, which typically Argentina is going to be grass-fed, of course. In America, more likely to be either grass-fed and corn-finished or just corn-fed the whole way. But if you really want to go Argentinian style, I would say get a grass-fed, grass-finished beef.
Steve, let me ask you one more thing. It's totally off the subject of grilling, but maybe it's germane to the sides for cookouts tomorrow. The New York Times this week suggested to readers that they put peas, like green peas, in their guacamole. You're from Chicago. You know how Mexican food has gotten a lot of nouveau treatments, some good, some bad. Where do you weigh in on the peas meets mashed avocado?
Yeah, I saw that the president weighed in on that as well. And I think, you know, as a fellow Chicagoan, I got to side with him. Peas don't belong in guacamole. I mean, come on. That's someone with too much time on their hands in a test kitchen. Guacamole is avocado, folks. Maybe with a little bit of lime juice, occasionally stirring in some chopped tomatoes, maybe some tomatillos, salt. Done. End of story. Peace not required.
Steve Dolinsky said so. The President of the United States said so. I don't even need to weigh in here. Steve Dolinsky in Los Angeles telling us about grilling around the world and his opinion on peas and guacamole. Thank you.
My pleasure. Happy 4th.
Yeah, I saw Steve's pictures of that yakitori joint in L.A., the white hot coals, the shishito peppers, the char on the chicken skin. Really trying hard not to think about it right now, but I invite you to think about it. See those pics and learn a whole lot more about the art of yakitori at PRI.org. Now, if you've got some downtime this weekend, and we hope you do, may I recommend you turn on the radio. The world's man in London, Leo Hornack, will have a story on This American Life. It's called Abdi and the Golden Ticket. Leo joins me now from London. Leo, tell me what this is about, this story.
I was distracted by the yakitori. It's making me hungry here. But more importantly, this is a story that I actually originally did for the BBC, and it's something that kind of crept up and started to kind of completely overtake my life. The State Department does a very odd thing, which is it gives away at random 50,000 green cards to people chosen completely by lottery around the world every year. And I got in touch with a young guy who is living, he's a Somali refugee living in a very tough area of Nairobi. And his name is Abdi. And I thought it was going to be this sort of feel-good story. I was going to trace him all the way through to his kind of glorious passage to America. And I interviewed him very early on, and I asked him if he thought he was lucky. But he said, no, my nickname has always been Abdi the American. He just saw it as his destiny. It was supposed to be a feel-good story, but if you tune in, you'll find out that, in fact, winning a golden ticket to America is not the same as getting to America, and he has to overcome an enormous amount of obstacles. And we were there every step of the way interviewing him almost on a daily basis. Even when he had to go into hiding at one point, he still kept a Skype connection and we kept talking.
Well, you've got me in the tent. I will listen this weekend. The world's Leo Hornack. You can hear Leo's story this weekend on This American Life online or on a public radio station near you. Leo, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
You're tuned to The World. I'm Marco Werman. A Colombian woman remembers the first time she had a meal with her kidnappers.
I stood in the entrance of the little rudimentary kitchen they had built. My heart was beating like absolutely fast.
Breakfast with the FARC, plus a 411 on July 4th fireworks. That's coming up on The World.
Support for The World comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 15,000 skills like Hungarian, hula hooping, and HTML. Curious.com. Grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Colombia, a country once rife with violence, had seemed pretty calm lately, but this summer is proving otherwise. In the past few weeks, there's been a series of attacks on oil pipelines in rural parts of the country. Those attacks were carried out by FARC rebels. Then yesterday, two separate explosions rocked the capital, Bogota. At least 7 people were hurt, though none of the injuries were severe. Both of yesterday's bombs targeted a private pension firm called Porvenir. Joshua Goodman is with the Associated Press. He's the AP bureau chief in Bogota. There's speculation that yesterday's attacks on this pension fund were carried out by the FARC, but there's no blame on one specific group. What do we know about who is responsible?
We know very little at this stage. There is speculation that it could be the rebels, but that's really just because the rebels have been stepping up attacks in other parts of the country. The capital has so far been spared any violent attacks from the FARC, as far as we know. Authorities are offering awards for information. They're looking at security cameras right now. They're seeing the people who may have dropped off packages. There apparently was a call to one of the branches before the bomb went off. But we really don't know who carried this out. It's sort of just speculation at this point.
Right. Can you think of any reason attackers would target this particular pension firm?
Not specifically this target, but what is true is that these sort of explosions and blasts are not unique even to the capital. There's a lot of criminal gangs and a lot of extortion rackets in Colombian cities. So this could very well have just been a private vendetta.
I was in Bogota in 2009, and a day before I got there, a Blockbuster video store was blown up, and nobody really knew why or how. And every parking lot for the following weeks had an extra lineup of security cops scanning the bottom of cars for bombs. What's the mood right now in Bogota?
One of these two attacks yesterday was at the heart of the financial district. I actually was at a reception to celebrate July 4th at the U.S. ambassador's residence, only 7 blocks away from the scene. And, you know, everyone at the party was surprised and a little bit rattled. It's not so common that wealthier neighborhoods of the capital experience this sort of violence. I think the attack you're referring to at that Blockbuster may have been one of the last. I think overall, nobody is expecting to see a major terrorist attack like the ones we saw in 2003, for example, in the capital at a private social club that killed dozens of people. But I will say, precisely because Bogota has made strides in terms of reducing terrorist attacks, if you will, or attacks by the rebels, people now have grown accustomed to having safety in their daily lives. That has created some concern among authorities that Bogota perhaps isn't prepared if the violence from the rebels in the country comes to the capital.
Right. So, for example, those attacks on oil pipelines seems to have been attributed to the FARC. But generally, what is the status of the FARC right now? I thought that, for the most part, many of the fighters were calling it quits.
The FARC and the government have been engaged in peace talks for almost 3 years. And progress was very slow but steady until about April, May, when there was a series of attacks on both sides, army bombings of guerrilla camps, guerrilla attacks on army platoons while they were sleeping, that have really sort of sullied the environment and the mood. I think a few months ago, the entire country was expecting a peace deal to be signed sometime soon in the coming months. Now, the recent polls that we're seeing because of these attacks have shown that actually Colombians overall favor, for the first time since the peace talks began, a military solution to the country's long-running conflict. So both sides in this conflict are sort of retrenching.
So how hard is it to generalize about violence in Colombia these days? FARC-related, drug-related?
Yeah.
Are people confused?
Yeah, I mean, very hard. You know, a lot of the violence here has nothing to do with the country's conflict. It's generated by criminal gangs, extortion rackets, drug trafficking. I think what you're going to see, though, is some politicians may try to blame the FARC, but we have to really look carefully at what evidence they present if indeed they do start to blame the rebels for these attacks.
That was Joshua Goodman in Bogota. He's the bureau chief for the Associated Press there. For decades now, armed guerrilla groups in Colombia have resorted to kidnapping to achieve their political aims. So that's why when the FARC kidnapped a young girl named Laura Ulloa in 2001, few in Colombia were surprised. But when she got released a year later, her story took a strange twist. Here's reporter Camila Kerwin.
On September 20th, 2001, Laura Ulloa boarded her school bus in Cali. She grabbed a seat in the back with the other 11-year-olds.
And then suddenly I saw the two cars were parked in the road and the bus had to stop.
5 guys with guns got on the bus. One of them ordered everyone to put their heads down. Laura didn't realize it at the time, but he was her family's former gardener. The men pulled Laura out of the bus, and in less than an hour she was walking in the brush of the Cordillera Mountains alongside a group of about 30 FARC guerrillas. This was day one of her kidnap for ransom.
I felt like a really, really bad energy, like if they hated me. So I started to be not nice. I thought they would maybe say, I know, this girl is, she's like so spoiled. Why don't we just let her go and we go for another one?
For a week or so, Laura hardly ate, bathed, or spoke. Her FARC captor stopped talking to her. She felt lonely, afraid. So one day, she made a seemingly small decision. She would get up early and join them for breakfast.
I stood in the entrance of the little rudimentary kitchen they had built. My heart was beating like absolutely fast. And I looked at them and asked, good morning, how are you? That was one of the most important days because the whole story changed.
This is when Laura says she began to know her captors. She talks about traveling the mountains with them, helping them gather wood, and listening to their stories. They never physically harmed her, she says. But it wasn't all summer camp. Once, they convinced her that her parents had divorced in her absence. She remembers sobbing, thinking it was her fault. 7 months would pass before she saw her family again. Laura shows me a home video of her return in 2002. She's standing in the middle of her bedroom, surrounded by relatives. She talks about the cards she left for her FARC captors and the small gifts they gave her.
Being kidnapped showed me that the actual victims were them. Many of them were abused. Many of them were displaced. I didn't consider myself as a victim because I have had everything all of my life.
I brought you water.
Cool, thank you. I met Laura and her mom, Liliana, at the family's house in Cali. We sat outside their home with a view of the mountains where Laura was held for 7 months. Her parents paid a ransom, though they never told her how much. Liliana says though they were desperate for Laura's return, in some ways her homecoming was unsettling. She seemed too cheerful about her experience.
Oh, that was awful. When you're talking about the nice trip, it has been a bad trip. Uh-huh. For us.
It's funny how in the video, it's like me unpacking as if I had just arrived from Miami. And all the kids were like, hi, that's so cool. And the adult was, is this real?
Laura says she understands now. But at the time, it was hard for her family to deal with the way she identified with her captors. She even came home with camouflage sweatpants. Some people might think that she was somehow brainwashed during her months in the mountains. Stockholm syndrome. And Laura understands that.
I was with a group of people 7 months. I talked to them all of the day. I did everything with them. It's obvious that I was going to feel some kind of attachment. But I wouldn't be sure to say what happened to me was Stockholm syndrome if I take it out of the context, but because I was kidnapped, maybe I could say it was.
She concedes this with a bit of uncharacteristic self-doubt. But she still resists the conclusion that she was a victim in this story. She says, sure, her captors changed her, but she changed them too.
And at the end, we are Colombians. Colombians, essentially.
For The World, I'm Camila Kerwin, Cali, Colombia.
July 4th, in Washington, D.C., 2014. Ah, the grand finale. It was one of an estimated 14,000 fireworks displays across the country last year, around this time. We take the pyrotechnics for granted, but I was kind of curious, when did this fireworks frenzy on the 4th get started, and why? Well, luckily, the world's one-man history desk and resident gunpowder specialist, Chris Wolf, sits just a few feet away from me in the newsroom. So fireworks, Chris, what up?
Well, you can look right back to 1776 and a letter that John Adams wrote to his wife, Abigail. And I'll quote for you, if I may. It says, "This day will be the most memorable epocha in the history of America. I am apt to believe that it will be celebrated by succeeding generations as the great anniversary festival. It ought to be commemorated as the day of deliverance by solemn acts of devotion to God Almighty. And it ought to be solemnized with pomp and parade, with shows, games, sports, guns, bells, and bonfires and illuminations from one end of this continent to the other, from this time forward, forevermore, this, the second day of July, 1776.
Second day of July? What happened to the fourth day of July?
Well, the second day was when Congress voted for independence. They approved the text on the 4th and rushed it to the printers.
All right. In that letter by John Adams you just quoted, he says, bonfires and illuminations. No actual specific mention of fireworks. Is there a difference, or is that what he meant?
It's not really clear. Bonfires, everybody knows. Illuminations is something that was unique kind of to the 18th century. Imagine colonial America, everything is dark, right? At night, there's no light for illumination unless you're very rich. And so when there was a big celebration in town, they would have an illumination, which is everyone was supposed to put lights in their windows just to show, you know, candles or something like that. Fireworks were kind of different, obviously, but they kicked in pretty soon because on July the 4th, 1777, you have fireworks displays to mark independence in both Boston and in Philadelphia.
So when do fireworks start becoming more widespread? When do we have definitive proof that people are going out and buying firecrackers and Roman candles for the 4th of July?
Well, I mean, fire has been used by mankind since the dawn of time for his celebrations, and it's still used all over the world by all cultures for special days like Bonfire Night in England, Chinese New Year. And in fact, it was the Chinese who first manufactured gunpowder. They would have traditional fire arrows for celebrations, and they decided to put little boxes of gunpowder on it, which would blow up in the air. Then they got to rockets. And then you get big extravaganzas of fireworks by the time of the Renaissance, 1500s, and then it skipped the Atlantic and around the 18th century. And there are plenty of examples of fireworks displays being used for celebrations, even during the American Revolution. Artillery officers would use the same kind of black powder in their cannon and show off their skills as pyrotechnic masters with putting on fireworks displays for special days.
I think of the line in the Star-Spangled Banner, the rocket's red glare. Is there anything to suggest that fireworks on the 4th of July are supposed to emulate the victory of wars of past years?
In a sense, yes. I mean, that was what the first kind of rocket and gunpowder displays were about. They'd usually be accompanied by cannon fire, which is kind of less obvious now, but you still see it in the Boston Pops during the 1812 overture. Mm. But the fireworks spread kind of slowly. It was around, started off after independence in New England, a little bit in New York, but really didn't become more widespread till you get the Star-Spangled Banner written during the War of 1812 and the rocket's red glare and all that. So there was an association, but it really was kind of later. It wasn't really the main event for Independence Day.
If you go back to some of the early fireworks, what did they look like?
Well, that's one of the reasons it didn't seem quite so spectacular, because until about the 1830s, it was just orange and white flashes in the sky, which is kind of cool for, you know,
for the 1830s.
Pre-industrial society. But it's only then in the 1830s that people discovered that if you put different kinds of metal in there, you could get different colors. And so it really takes off through the 19th century. I failed chemistry dismally, so I'm not going to be able to tell you what.
Sounds good. I'm going to definitely make sure you stay away from the chemistry lab tomorrow, though. What are you doing for the 4th, Chris?
Well, I'll be setting off my own gunpowder as an American citizen now. I'm marching as a colonial militiaman in a small town parade, and I'll be firing my musket to celebrate our independence.
The world's history guy, Chris Wolfe, you have a blast tomorrow.
Okay, thank you.
We left you hanging with a story the other day. We also left pilot Andre Borschberg hanging in a solar-powered plane over the Pacific Ocean.
This particular flight is really on the edge of the envelope. It's a 5-day flight. He's committed now. He's past the point of no return. So making Hawaii is really, they're really exposed right now.
That was John Hansman of MIT on our Tuesday edition of The World. He was telling us about Borschberg's flight on Solar Impulse 2, a plane completely powered by the sun. A few days back, Borschberg was beginning the longest leg of an around-the-world trip in the plane, a 5-day solo flight across the Pacific from Japan to Hawaii. So, did he make it? Well, let's put it this way. He got a lei around his neck.
There you go. 4 days, 21 hours and 51 minutes, 8,259 kilometers.
Great.
A historic first for aviation.
Borschberg touched down outside of Honolulu at dawn local time this morning. At 120 hours, it was the longest solo flight ever, and the plane did it without a drop of fuel, powered instead by 17,000 solar cells mounted on its immense wings. Borschberg himself says his own fuel during the flight was just as renewable. He used yoga and meditation. First thing he says he wants to do now, after 5 days in the air, take a shower. Next stop for Solar Impulse 2, after a Hawaiian layover, Phoenix, Arizona. Coming up after the break, Muslim punk rock from a band called The Cominas, here on The World.
The World's Global Nation education coverage is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, part of the American Graduate Let's Make It Happen initiative, supporting communities as they work to end the dropout crisis. AmericanGraduate.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. This is Muslim punk, not a new sound. Its roots go back to the late 1970s. This band, the Cominas, have been at the cutting edge of the Muslim punk movement since 2005. The name, by the way, means scoundrels, and a decade later, the Cominas are still key players on the scene and still working on their scoundrel side.
Going around and stealing.
Again and Again, that's a new track from the new album by the Cominas. The album's called Stereotype. I've got Bassem Usmani and Shahjahan Khan, two members of the band, with me. We're just missing Karna Ray and Sunny Ali. But you guys can handle it. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
It's good to be back.
Just because of his belief, they called him a liar and a thief. I'm not the Pakistani culture king.
I'm not the Pakistani urban king. It's
the Comunas have got a new CD out called Stereotype. What are you saying about stereotypes?
We deal with everything from, I mean, police brutality to obviously Islamophobia. A song like Pigs Are Haram, which is a Sonny's kind of, for me, it's his like opus for me on this album. It's just, it's a 50-second, you know, just in your face, ridiculously hardcore song, which
it's
is
very
a
hardcore.
And it's, and he's tackling like two, he's almost like playing two different characters lyrically of like, you know, acting like the police officer and then talk like speaking from the point of view of the police officer and then from the point of view of the person that he's arresting.
I have to say that eluded me in the 50 seconds of just like power noise that
yeah.
song is. I mean, that's one of the problems, I think, of punk and heavy metals. It's really hard to
yeah,
hear what's
sure.
going on. But
sure.
your fans get it.
Yeah, well, yeah. we've made sure to throw the lyrics up this time because a lot of people have asked over the years, like, you know, I love your songs, but, like, what are the lyrics? You know, so we threw them up there.
Not today, not today.
Pure punk, partly from Pakistan. You see, when the Comunas formed, it was made up of Pakistani Americans based here in the Boston area. Then they decamped to Pakistan for a few years to try doing their thing there. They're back in the States now, but the Comunas' experience in Pakistan is still with them.
I feel like the culture brought me over there in a big way. When it came to the music that we were already experimenting with, I just felt that I needed to learn a little bit more about Punjabi. I need to learn a little bit more about Pakistan. I sort of felt like a little bit hapless because we immediately became this weird meme in the media as soon as we formed as this Muslim punk band in 2005, which like we
in
ran
in the U.S. media.
In the U.S.
Yeah,
media.
In the U.S. media.
And there's a lot of misreporting. There's a lot of things that were said. There's a lot of agendas that people kind of put on top of us.
What is Muslim punk? Because I think that confuses a lot of people. People think punks are angry, therefore
sure.
you must be angry Muslims.
I would say primarily now the way we would say is we're kind of a South Asian band that has written a bunch of Muslim punk songs. We definitely have made, you know, a couple of albums that like follow that trajectory, but that's not kind of like all we are. That's actually never all that we were. You know, we've always had non-Muslim members in the band. And it's unfortunately like with music like ours, I think it's kind of hard to like classify it all. So like, you need like one label here and there. And it was very problematic in the beginning. It's now kind of become part of this like rich tapestry of who we are. So we're not as like, it's not as uncomfortable for us to be described that way as long as people get the whole picture.
You're both Pakistani American, correct?
Yeah.
Correct. Yeah. So you've got this interesting perspective brought up in the Boston area, and then you go to Pakistan and you kind of engage in this musical moment for a couple of years. What changed in the view of Pakistanis toward the United States while you were there? I mean, it's been a dark few years in Pakistani-U.S. relations. You can go back as far as you want, but, you know, the killing of Osama, Bin Laden living right in Abbottabad, or, you know, Malala, who the West
sure.
raises as this kind of icon of progress and rights. What do Pakistanis think about the United States today?
It is a very cynical.
I would say that the biggest.
Yeah.
I mean, it's cynical, but there's a big. This is Shah Jahan. Yeah, sorry. there's a big misconception as far as like Pakistanis have always had a love for like American culture. That stuff hasn't necessarily changed. I would say, in terms of distrust of you know U.S. politics, like that's not something that's just the case in Pakistan. I mean, that's a lot of people like you know are down with like what our government and stuff is doing.
I asked partly because Bassem, you were saying before the interview started, just kind of what an incredible week or two it's been in
yeah.
the United States, and you've been talking with friends in Pakistan who
for sure.
What are they saying?
Well, I mean, and I'm sure Shaj can weigh in.
Yeah.
Ask
I mean, I'm referring to the Supreme Court
sure.
decision
yeah.
and
yep.
all sorts of stuff.
Yeah.
I mean,
that,
Charleston.
Yeah. So the past 2 weeks have been kind of eye-opening, I feel. I mean, that's my read of it for a lot of Pakistanis looking outside into America. For the first time, they're looking at America as, wait, this is a country that has an issue with race. Or, wait, this is a country that legalized gay marriage, might have been one of the last developed countries to legalize gay marriage. And all of a sudden, on my Facebook feed, I'm seeing people in Pakistan engage in these really intense discussions about gay marriage, about the ethics behind it, about racism in the USA, about churches being burnt down, where it seems like that there's an intrigue into America's problems that wasn't present before, because classically the way it's been has been America talking about all of the problems elsewhere.
We're going to hear what I consider my favorite song on the album, See Something, Say Something. But musically, talk about this, because it feels like you guys dropped the punk thing and kind of picked up some Alabama Shakes vibe or something.
I'll all default right. to Boston because they...
our definition of punk is informed by The Clash. They sort of filtered some of the best things about American rock and roll and packaged it as British people, the way that British people have been doing for decades.
Yeah.
And just sort of giving us back like this distilled American form.
Bassem Usmani and Shah Jahan Khan, two of the members of the Communists. Thanks very much for coming in. Good to see you again.
Thanks for having us, Marco.
If you see something, you better say something. Nothing at all, nothing at all.
The Comunas take us out today. Enjoy yourselves this weekend. Remember the sunscreen, drink plenty of water, and have a happy 4th of July. Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. Back with you Monday.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH. Brought to you by PRI's Global Reporting Fund, supporting its diverse reporting efforts, including ongoing global health coverage and its Across Women's Lives initiative. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman, Garrett and Cecilia Boone, the Gruber Family Foundation, Lynn and Bruce Dayton, and the Harold Simmons Foundation. By the Skoll Foundation, supporting innovative solutions to the world's most pressing problems with the Skoll Award for Social Entrepreneurship at skoll.org. By the Ford Foundation. By the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs. And by the PRI Ambassador Council, including Linda Larson and Jerry Johnson, the Rose Family Fund, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and Roger Hale and Noor Hall, and by the National Endowment for the Arts.
PRI, Public Radio International.